From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, as federal authorities investigate two more fatal police shootings of black men, we'll explore what the shocking videos tell us and why we need to watch them. Also today, questions about U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz. Is the federal prosecutor building a career indicting the good guys?
I have heard some of the claims, and I think they're actually very inaccurate. They're unfair, and they're unwarranted.
And Boston's Nantucket Lightship. It was a floating lighthouse manned by the Coast Guard 100 miles off the coast of Massachusetts in one of the most treacherous stretches of ocean.
In fact, that area of the Atlantic is known as one of the graveyards of the Atlantic. Over 700 shipwrecks have occurred on the shoals.
The Nantucket Lightship shines again. All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. The list grew longer this week to the names of Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, Walter Scott. We can add Alton Sterling and Philando Castile. Two more police shootings of two more black men. As federal officials investigate what happened in Louisiana and Minnesota this week, videos that are graphic and shocking seem to be on a continuous loop on TV, on the internet. They're difficult to watch, and some question if they should be shown so widely on the news or watched at all by the larger public. Boston Globe and WBUR contributor Renee Graham struggled with a decision to watch the footage or not, and her decision to watch them adds an important perspective to what's become an all-too-common American tragedy. And Renee Graham is with us, and thank you for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Anthony.
And listeners, this is a difficult conversation, but I think it's an important one. We want to invite you into it. Did you watch the videos of these recent police shootings? Do you think it's important to watch them? Or maybe not. Is it disrespectful somehow to the victims? Are you concerned at all about what sometimes feels like a continuous video loop of graphic violence dominating our lives now? You can give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Renee, before I get to you, I'm just going to recap some of the facts, what we know. So Tuesday night in Baton Rouge, two white police officers responded to a call about an armed man outside a convenience store. Cell phone videos taken by bystanders show 37-year-old Alton Sterling pinned to the ground by both officers when one pulls out his gun and fatally shoots Sterling. Four more shots ring out. There have been protests, and the Baton Rouge NAACP has called for the city's police chief to step down. The Justice Department has opened a civil rights investigation. One night later, Wednesday, in Falcon Heights, Minnesota, outside of St. Paul, during a traffic stop, a police officer shot 32-year-old Philando Castile. His girlfriend, Diamond Reynolds, and her young daughter were in the car, and Diamond Reynolds live-streamed the aftermath of that fatal shooting on Facebook, and we're going to hear an audio clip from that now. And listeners, this is graphic and difficult material to hear, so please be advised.
We got pulled over on Larpiner.
I told him not to reach for it. I told him to get his hand open.
You told him to get his ID, sir, and his driver's license. Oh, my God, please don't tell me he's dead. Please don't tell me my boyfriend just went like that.
Just keep your hands where they are, please.
Yes, I will, sir. I'll keep my hands where they are.
Renee Graham, you wrote very eloquently about this in the Globe today. What was your first reaction when you heard, I guess, about that first shooting? But I know you've seen the videos of both these shootings. What was your reaction?
Well, I saw a mention of the shooting on my phone early in the morning, and I immediately made the decision that I didn't want to watch it. Once I put the TV on, it was on all of the news shows, and I literally was turning from channel to channel to try to avoid seeing it. And then I had to ask myself, what was I trying to avoid? Hmm. You know, so I decided I would watch the video. And, you know, one of the reasons I watched the video is because I thought about, as I mentioned in the column, Mamie Till, whose son Emmett was murdered in Mississippi in 1955. And he was horribly butchered and brutalized. And she made the decision to have an open casket funeral. And what she said was, let the world see what they did to my baby.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's what I feel about these videos. Let the world see what's going on. You know, we weren't having these conversations when everyone didn't have a cell phone and we couldn't see these videos very easily. And I think the fact that they're there, we owe it to ourselves. We owe it to these people who are losing their lives pointlessly to bear witness to what is happening and to take that knowledge and do something productive with it.
Yeah, you wrote, I no longer feel I have the right to turn away. But let me just go back a bit. Why didn't you want to watch the videos at the beginning?
Because I felt like I'd seen so many of them.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and there's something really horrific about watching someone die. And that's what you're watching. You know, it's not a movie. It's not a funny clip. It's a man in the last minutes of his life. Mm-hmm. And it's nothing enjoyable about watching that. And it kind of stains you. It kind of burns into your soul when you see it. And I just thought, you know what? I've watched so many of these videos. I have no need or desire to see another one. But that also kind of cheapened what happened to Alton Sterling. I made his death just like all the others.
Yeah.
Oh, I've seen this before. And in fact, I hadn't seen it before because every life is different. Every life has its own, you know, precious qualities. And so by dismissing it and saying, well, I don't need to watch this, I felt like I was kind of demeaning and even devaluing his life. And that had already happened.
Sure. One of the concerns, with a lot of interesting conversations in the newsroom about this, and your column in particular sort of provoked this conversation. And one of the thoughts that came up, not so much pushback, but this idea of this continuing video loop, this continuous video loop that you see on cable TVs, all the TVs on the walls around WBUR, for example, and it sort of gives the impression that this is the world right now, and this is all there is in the world right now. That concerns me. I'm not saying we shouldn't watch them, but I guess I'm asking, are you concerned? What do we do about the sort of saturation of this video?
Well, I think there's a wrong way and a right way to do this sort of thing. I remember when Walter Scott, who was shot by a police officer in North Charleston, South Carolina, when he died, CNN had a story. And during the course of the report, they were just literally running him getting shot in the back several times over and over and over again. You know, that kind of saturation, I think, is ridiculous because then it just numbs you out at a certain point. It's like it goes back to the beginning and he's running and he gets shot and he falls. And he's running, he gets shot and he falls. You know, that's not productive. But I think when you have a situation like you have with Alton Sterling and also now with Philando Castile, you have to see what's happening. You have to get a sense of what it is. You know, not just, you know, okay, what were the circumstances, but also like what happened to these people? You know, how do you go from a traffic stop to getting shot and dying in front of your child? You know, so I think there is an importance in that. And, you know, like I said, if we didn't have these videos, we wouldn't be having these conversations because, you know, the idea is that, oh my God, this is happening again. My guess is these happen all the time. But there's no video. If you remember, Alton Sterling was shot very early Tuesday morning. People didn't really start talking about it until Wednesday because that's when the video became
public.
That's
when the video surfaced. Well, let me introduce Michael Curry. I'm really happy that he's in the studio, president of the Boston branch of the NAACP. And Michael Curry, thank you for coming in, and thank you for sitting patiently for the first few minutes of this conversation.
Glad to be here.
You've been listening to Renee. What's your view on the importance of seeing these videos, hard as they are to watch?
You know, Renee's comment, I think, was spot on. It reminds me of a W.E.B. Du Bois quote that I always live by. It says, nothing can be solved that can't be faced. And again, that's nothing can be solved that can't be faced. And the reality is, this is not new, right? We had Time magazine, the cover was Amadou Diallo, the shooting of Amadou Diallo. And we paid attention for a little while, and then we turned it off. There was the Crawford man shot at the store. I think it was Walmart. These cases are not new, and it's really a rampant issue across the country where black and brown men are viewed as violent, as threats, as thugs, and there's an overreaction by law enforcement. We as a society would love to turn away and say, well, they must have been a bad person. They must have been a thug. They should have listened. They should have complied. This is something that we all have to pay attention to, and if we don't, we will turn on our TVs next week, and there'll be more of these cases, and there'll be another life loss or lives lost. This is forcing us to pay attention. So though 24-hour news cycle and we're saturated with this stuff, good. Because just like we was talked about with Emmett Till, America's being forced to pay attention to itself.
And let me bring this back to Boston. And I want to ask you this question. I mean, I don't want to sound overconfident or smug in any way. This hasn't happened in Boston. Boston Police Commissioner, our police commissioner has a pretty good reputation in this city. There's some pretty good training going on. Michael Curry, speak to that issue, the sense that why this hasn't happened in Boston and how Boston still needs to take care that it doesn't happen.
Well, I think you have to look at sort of the what happens in other cities that lead to the death and then lead to the protest. The reality is our police department is still predominantly white male, yeah. right? So there's still a diversity issue on law enforcement, and that plays out in how people police and how they interact with the community, what perceptions they have of the community. That's still a problem here. Two, we have communities that are over-policed, that people get stopped who are not criminals and who are not engaged in anything, and there's a tension that exists in Boston, in Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan, East Boston. So some of the elements that we're seeing in other places are here, too. Some of the things I would give credit for in this police department, particularly Boston Police Department, is that we have a Lisa Holmes who runs the training for the officers, and she gets into issues of racism, implicit bias. She's getting into things that most of those officers have never thought about, never engaged in, and she's sort of deconstructing how they see communities of color. That's a process. We get called in to look at videos when there is a shooting, so there's an immediate conversation. Within 24 hours, we're in the police
And when you department. Say we, you're talking about community leaders?
Community leaders, yep. clergy, civil rights leaders, right. Activists. We get in the room, and they really present the videos to us, and we get to have a conversation, and we've said to them, don't just show us the video when it looks good for you. Mm-hmm. Show us the video when it looks bad for you, and we want to see every angle you have and every witness that comes up with a new angle and a new version. We want to know that as well.
And have there been examples of that, when they've actually said, here's a video that doesn't make us look so good, we want you to see it?
We haven't gotten to that yet, because there's only been a few shootings by police officers here since they've instituted this. That was the Humboldt shooting with the young man that was shot on Humboldt. The police officer was shot in the face. We got in and saw that video right away. The concern I have here is really going back to our push for body cameras. Boston is not immune from this stuff. It could happen here tomorrow, and Commissioner Evans can assure you that none of his officers will not overreact, that they don't walk out on streets and see black and brown men as a threat and might be overreactive or progress in use of force much too soon and break from their policy or their practice. He can't guarantee that, which is why we want a transparency in how we police in this community. And videos that can show us the true account. People lie. And it doesn't matter how saintly you are, how good of a person you are. If you're about to be held accountable for using force, there's a tendency for people not to tell the whole story.
Sure. Yeah. Or maybe even perhaps to give them credit in that moment, not remember the whole
story.
Renee, I'd love to sort of get your perspective on your feeling about how Boston relates to this, or how this relates to what's happening here in Boston.
You know, I think in some ways Boston's been lucky. You know, I think that, you know, they have certain things in place and, you know, the way they deal with the community. But I also think it's luck. You know, it just hasn't happened here. I hope it doesn't happen here. I don't want to, as you said, I don't want to say it hasn't happened here yet. But it could certainly happen here, because the tensions are all still in place. You know, so I think, you know, it's important that the police see this need to be out in the communities to create a relationship with the people they police. But, you know, it's a very, very thin line. And every time one of these shootings happens, it makes everyone else more nervous. It makes the cops more nervous. It makes the communities more nervous.
Right.
Puts everybody on edge. So, yeah, I think it's great. It hasn't happened here. But I think the police force, you know, starting with Commissioner Evans, needs to be aware of the fact that it could happen here.
Listeners, we're talking to Renee Graham, Boston Globe columnist and WBUR contributor, and Michael Curry, president of the Boston branch of the NAACP, about these terrible events that happened this week. Two more police shootings of black men. We're talking about the videos and the importance of seeing these videos. Have you seen them? Do you feel that it's important to see them? Do they worry you in any way? So let's take a couple of calls. We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to Margo. She's calling from Roxbury. Margo, good to have you.
Good afternoon. I wanted to make a quick statement about your opening salvo.
Sure.
Which was to watch or not to watch. I believe that was your question.
Yep, that was it.
And as a black community resident, as a black mother, grandmother, friend of black men, black boys here in Roxbury, we don't have the option of watching or not watching, cutting it off, not cutting it off. It's part of our history. It's part of our daily existence. It's part of our fear every day when we walk out the door with our sons, our husbands, and our brothers. So it's really nice for people to have the option to sit in their living room and to cut it on or off. But that is not our reality. And the delusion, and although it's good to hear that things in Boston are being given attention now. Let us not go under the illusion that these things have not happened in Boston and that they will not happen in the future. Thank you.
Margo, eloquently expressed. Thanks very much for the call. And in Margo's statement, Renee, I hear a lot of what you wrote. I mean, I quoted this a moment ago. I no longer feel I have the right to turn away. It is my duty to bear witness to the actions of those sworn to protect and serve.
Well, I think what's always interesting with these videos is there are people who look at it and say, oh, my God, I can't believe that happens.
Yeah.
And many people of color will say, yeah, that's been happening for decades. We've been telling you about it. You just weren't paying attention.
Mm.
But here, now you have proof of what's going on in our communities and how our people are dying needlessly.
Yeah.
So, I, you know, Margo made a very good point.
Let's go to Mary. She's calling from Andover. Mary, you're on the air. Good to have you.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think my comment echoes or is an add-on to Margo's comment. I'm a media literacy teacher, and the majority of my students in an affluent Massachusetts town are white, and when they experience violence like this, it's in TV or movies or video games where they know that the actors didn't really die, or they can reset the game and, oh, you know, that person's back up again. There's another life to add on. I think it's vital for people who don't live this experience to see these videos so they can't turn away anymore. And as uncomfortable as they are for us to see, we have to see them, because if we don't see them, we don't genuinely believe that anything's happening. It's too easy to turn our backs and say, oh, yeah, whatever, you know, there's another one. So I think it's vital that as uncomfortable as it is, we see these. And then I think there's a second part, that people have to have more than conversations amongst themselves about it. They need to talk to community leaders. They need to talk to their representatives in government and say, now how do we fix this problem? Because it does affect all of us. Thank you.
Mary, stay with us. Are you still with us? Because actually there's a question I want to ask you as an educator, a media literacy teacher, and that is the prevalence of these videos and how easy they are for everyone to see. And I'm just wondering what concerns you have or the kind of thinking you've done when it comes to very young people seeing these videos for whom it might not be time yet.
Sure. I teach high school, so there's definitely a different scenario. It's clearly different for elementary and middle school students. It's easier for my students to see this. They've built a shield by the age they reach me. But I think it's crucial that they see it. And then I think that there need to be conversations with younger students. Maybe they don't see the video, but someone has a conversation with them about current events, about what's happening. Young children, I think the more we shield them, the less opportunity they have to practice the media literacy skills they need to look at a variety of video and say, okay, this isn't reality and this is reality, when they are old enough to see the more difficult ones. So I think it's a very fine balance we need to achieve between protecting our children, our young children, but also helping them build the skills that they need so that they do realize what their world is truly like.
Mary, thanks so much for the call. We really appreciate it. Michael Curry, I'd like to sort of come to you with that same question, just about, you know, your view on the very young and sort of how to present this material to them in a way that, I guess, that helps them understand the world that they're in, but too much too soon, not a good thing.
You know, I struggle with that as a parent. I have three sons, and you heard many of the mothers who are traveling the country, Sabrina Fulton, Trayvon's mom, and other mothers talk about the reality that they've struggled with what to tell their children. I have to now, in the reality that we live in, talk to my young boys about these situations. I have an 8-year-old, a 13-year-old, and a 21-year-old in college. I no longer think to myself, well, maybe I just will wait to have that conversation, because I have to have it now.
And when you say that conversation, you're talking about the conversation essentially of being in America while black.
Being in America while black, the threat of being in America while black,
yeah,
that being stopped by being black, and all that comes with it, that you are perceived as a threat.
Yeah.
And we have not in this country come to a point where we're willing to have that conversation, that whether we teach them, whether we police them, educate them, go down the list, we are treating people differently because of the perception we have of them. We are medicating and prescribing differently based on how we perceive them. And it's playing out on our streets. So I have 30 young kids who just started in our office this week. They spent all day today looking at the details around Baton Rouge and Minnesota and debating it and talking about it. And they range in age from 13 to 19. They need to understand it, and then they need to be the change agents on how to deal with it.
Let's take another call. Jamal Crawford is calling. Jamal, you're the editor of Blackstonian, and you're calling from Roxbury. Good to have you.
Yes, indeed. I just want to say this, that when we have these conversations, particularly in Boston around policing, that I think it's really important that we get away from the false narrative that it doesn't happen here or it hasn't happened here as of yet. We've had a spate of killings here by Boston police. Pretty much is basically about one per year for the past 20 years or so. And many of these, you know, the more recent ones that have been, you know, sensationalized, where the perpetrators may have had a weapon and there's video immediately released, those obviously often favor the police and the DA. But the ones that are a little bit more sketchy, those don't get the same answers. Video was missing. I could give you one case, Mark McMullen, who was a man who was chased from Roxbury all the way out to Kingston, I think, Rockland, Mass., against all department protocol, high-speed chase, out of the city jurisdiction. Dispatchers telling the officer, no, no, don't do it. Still happens. The guy ends up dead out there in Rockland. The family, whom I'm still in contact with, that happened in 2011. The family still hasn't even received the man's belongings. Has been stonewalled by the BPD, by the DA, Suffolk DA Dan Conley, and the DA in the district of where it ended up occurring, which I believe is Plymouth, don't quote me. But in any event, I want to get away from the false narrative that it doesn't happen here. The BPD, we need to push for a new level of transparency and accountability, because we do have major problems here. And all you have to do is go look at the headlines of Boston Globe, the Herald, your radio show, and others, just to look at the history of the BPD, whether it's the hiring and firing and termination practices, whether it's drunk driving, whether it's drug use, steroid use, domestic violence, the Uber incident. We can go on and on and on. I just don't want to...
Jamal, you make the point. You make the point really, really well, and you actually echo a point that both Michael Curry and Renee Graham made. We don't want to sort of pretend that we can sit on our laurels in this city. We're part of a country, and this country has a long history of complicated legacy with race, and we're still sorting it out. And maybe Boston's doing better than some cities. But go ahead, Michael Curry.
Yeah, just to add to that, I think Jamal's right. I think, and I've said this as many places as people will hear me say it, that it takes time sometimes for truth to catch up to history. This has always been happening in this country. The reality is the 24 news cycle, the social media has now lifted the sheet off of all of this stuff that's happening across the country. I use that analogy for a reason. That now we're at a point, we're starting to see the realness that happens on our streets and communities, whether Southside Chicago, East St. Louis, or Roxbury. So he's right. It's happened here. We need to kind of go back in history and look at what those cases that really need to be reopened and looked at.
All right. That's Michael Curry, president of the Boston branch of the NAACP. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And Renee Graham, thank you for bringing this important idea to us today. She's the Boston Globe columnist and WBUR contributor. Great to have you.
Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you very much. And listeners, stay with us. We've got a lot more coming up. And by the way, thanks for your calls. If you didn't get a chance, you can leave a comment at radioboston.org or on Facebook at Radio Boston. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Here's the provocative headline from the Huffington Post yesterday criticizing the U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts, Carmen Ortiz. Quote, this federal prosecutor is building a career indicting the good guys, end quote. The article contends that Ortiz's latest case against two Boston City Hall employees for allegedly employing union strong-arm tactics is the latest in a long string of cases where she is, quote, bringing the full force of the law down on some semi-high-profile people for minor or legally ambiguous crimes. It lays out a number of cases since 2009 when Ortiz took the helm for the District of Massachusetts, including the high-profile case against internet activist Aaron Swartz, who committed suicide in 2013. WBUR senior reporter David Boeri has investigated and reported on a number of these cases and taken a close look at Carmen Ortiz's record, and he's here with us now. David, good to have you.
Thanks, Anthony.
As always. And also with us is former federal judge Nancy Gertner. She's a senior lecturer on law at Harvard and a WBUR legal analyst. Nancy, great to see you.
Nice to be here.
David, I want to start with you. So not the first time that Ortiz's office has been accused of sort of prosecutorial overreach. You've covered this for a long time, as I mentioned. You've been in the studio and talked about it quite eloquently. First of all, what do you make of the Huffington Post piece? Because in many ways, it echoes a lot of what you found.
Yeah, and that was a while ago. So some of these are old. These are old stories by now, perhaps. And I think of that of the piece that they've done as being designed to bring in the cavalry with regard to Ortiz's prosecution of the two administration people in Mayor Walsh's office. When what's, you know, and that seemed to be a growing investigation of the unions and, of course, of Walsh himself. But the authors themselves say they were out to rescue her targets, Ortiz's targets in the covered investigation, that she's out to get progressives and thus they're out to get her. And you look at that title, Building a Career Indicting Good Guys. Well, that may well be an overstatement, and there's some errors in that piece. But it covers a number of these stories that I've covered, as we've talked about, and that have brought strong criticism to Ortiz, even from federal judges. And now, surprisingly, from Martha Coakley, the former Attorney General of Massachusetts.
Right. Tell us what Martha Coakley said. I mean, she talked about, she was quoted in that Huffington Post article. What did she have to say? Well,
she raises this question of priorities. And that's what this comes down to. Discretion that prosecutors have of what you go after and whether it's fair or not. You know, I want to read, if you will, let me, a statement that the Attorney General, Robert Jackson, famous Attorney General, made in 1940 to an assembly of U.S. attorneys, because it's very pertinent here. He said, "The prosecutor has more control over life, liberty, and reputation than any other person in America. His discretion is tremendous." Now, he told them, justice may be blind, but law enforcement is not blind. One of the greatest difficulties of the position of prosecutor is that he or she must pick his cases because no prosecutor can even investigate all of the cases in which he receives complaints. And the point is, if the prosecutor is obliged to choose his cases, it follows that he can choose his defendants. Therein is the most dangerous power of the prosecutor, that he will pick people that he thinks should get rather than pick cases that need to be prosecuted. Mm-hmm. And that is the case against Ortiz, that she's not shown proper discretion, that she has been unrestrained, and that's epitomized in the case of Aaron Swartz.
And we're going to talk about that. I want to talk about a couple specific cases, but I want to get Nancy into this conversation. You're quoted in the Huffington Post piece calling the indictment of the two Walsh administration officials as an abuse of power. And
right.
just some background on that. Kenneth Brissett, the city's tourism chief, and Timothy Sullivan indicted for conspiracy and extortion for withholding city permits from a music festival unless it hired union stagehands. Why is that an example of an abuse of power?
Well, you have to read the indictment very closely. Neither man had the authority to withhold anything. They were not involved in the permitting process. The people who could control the permitting process, in fact, told them not to do it. They got nothing in return. Typically, extortion involves obtaining something of value in exchange for something else. They got nothing in return. So this doesn't map onto anything that we've ever seen before of extortion. The one thing that we learned from the recent Supreme Court McDonald case, the case against Governor McDonald, whose conviction was just reversed and remanded, is that the criminal law has to be clear. This is really a stretch. One of the things I've said actually on this program before is that union advocacy is baked into the Boston government. Unions literally have a seat at the table in various commissions. If someone who had no authority over the process told people that they needed to be union in order to get a permit, it would be wrong, but it does not fit within the statute. It is not fit within the extortion statute at all.
Hmm. David?
And what's interesting about this case, both involving McDonald in Virginia and up here in several of these cases, there are no bags of cash. Nobody is profiting directly. That was true in the O'Brien case, the probation department case. That is true here. There are no charges. These guys are getting money. Anyone's getting money. And so that makes it different, and it makes it much more vague and hazy, and this is what Nancy is talking
about. But couldn't you argue that they are sort of trying to compel a company or an interest, in this case the Boston Calling Music Festival, to spend a whole bunch of money that they might not want to spend?
They may be trying to do that. They may well be trying to do that. The issue is whether that is a crime.
I see.
And when you look at the indictment also talks about how in 2014 the administration of the city of Boston changed. The implication being that somehow this began with Mayor Walsh's administration. I dug into that a little bit. At one point, Mayor Menino decried the fact that Clear Channel, the company, was hiring replacement workers to break a strike. Union advocacy, this kind of, quote, compulsion for an important constituency, is baked into Boston politics. The lesson of the McDonald case, is we may not like this at all. It may be, as in the McDonald case, tawdry. But you have to then enact laws that are clear. What you can't do is squeeze a round peg into a square hole, which is what this is doing. So two individuals who had no authority over the permitting process at all may have said things that we wish they had not said in exchange for no money. Maybe they should be fired. Maybe we should change the laws. But it is not extortion as that is understood in the law.
Are we, though? I mean, to just talk in, and I don't want to just get too bogged down on the City Hall case because I want to talk about some other cases. But this case, it hasn't gone to court yet. So there's a lot we still don't know about this case, right?
Right.
I mean,
right.
Yeah,
right.
You say it's an abuse of power. I don't know the facts. I'm not sure I'm willing to say it's an abuse of power. But it concerns people. We don't know what the rest of the story is. But it is certainly mystifying as to these two and what they've done that is clearly wrong. Or is it simply a matter of going after the small fry to get to the big fish?
But but the other thing is that when, you know, we saw this actually with Comey when he talked about Hillary Clinton's emails. So when there is an enormous power, the power to indict, particularly a public figure, has implications beyond the indictment. And so it seems to me that you don't file this kind of document. You don't go ahead unless you are absolutely sure. So maybe David is right. Maybe down there's something going on. Then you wait until you find out what's going on. The worst thing you do is to sort of besmirch reputations in this way when you don't have the goods. And looking at this indictment, I don't see where the goods are.
Mm. And Anthony, you have to, you know, it is in these cases, again, it's the power of the prosecutor. So if you are charged in these two cases involving Mayor Walsh's aides, both of them in the early morning hours, arrested in their homes, clearly not given a chance to shower, shave, or bring other clothes, brought out in handcuffs and into the courthouse. And then, of course, afterwards, because they have not committed crimes that are worthy of being held on bail, they're released and they go out into the pack, the frenzied pack out front. You wonder the effects on people's lives. And that's what makes this question about prosecuting and who you choose for your targets an important one.
Well, let's talk about one of the sort of best known cases that we spent a lot of time back in 2013 talking about. And one of the authors of the Huffington Post case actually told us that it was the prosecution of Aaron Swartz that brought Ortiz to their attention. David, just remind us of this very tragic case.
Brilliant, creative, and troubled idealist, a computer genius. And it's going to haunt Carmen Ortiz probably for the rest of her life because he committed suicide before going to court to face what were 13 federal felony charges. You know, he had downloaded some 4 million documents over at MIT from a fee-charging database of academic journals called JSTOR. And JSTOR asked that the charges be dropped. But in Wade Ortiz, in the U.S., her assistant U.S. attorney, piling up charges, and they used them to threaten Swartz with 35 years in prison in order to get him to plead guilty. They said, we never intended that. But those piled up charges were a reminder that if he went to court and said, I'm not guilty, he could be punished. And he insisted he was not guilty. And, you know, the phrase...
And let's just remind listeners who may have forgotten, of course, Aaron Swartz committed suicide before this case was even brought to trial.
And famously, or infamously, Ortiz rationalized her prosecution by saying, stealing is stealing. Mm-hmm. But in court, of course, stealing is not just stealing, and all crimes are not created equal. Mm-hmm. But as it appeared, no one in Ortiz's office questioned as to what could be gained by sending him to jail for 6 months. And to make matters worse, his lawyers say they warned the prosecutors he was suicidal.
Yeah. So, Nancy, is this another example, perhaps not completely dissimilar to this case in City Hall, that, again, this isn't a case about someone ending up with a bag of money or a whole lot of personal gain?
Well, there were actually legal defenses to the charges that they had brought against Swartz. Yeah. So it is pushing the envelope with respect to the criminal law, which the McDonald case and others suggest are exactly what you shouldn't do. And let me just sort of put it more broadly than that. Just because you can indict because someone stepped over the line doesn't mean you should. Hmm. The exercise of prosecutorial discretion is looking at the big picture. And there's a way in which it's almost as if the game, it's like the game of gotcha. Gee, you may have said something wrong, you know, the person who didn't have authority over the permitting process, but we're going to use this to indict you.
Well, we want to hear from Carmen Ortiz. We actually reached out to her office. The office declined to make her available today, but her spokesman did provide us with a statement. I'm going to read just a little bit about that. And this is in direct response to the Huffington Post piece. Quote, what is most offensive is the recent criticism by some regarding the diversity of our work and the types of cases our office prosecutes. And the statement goes on. The U.S. Attorney's Office is proud of the outstanding cases it investigates and prosecutes on behalf of countless victims and the residents of Massachusetts. And Nancy and David, if you'll just bear with us, I'm going to play a two-minute excerpt of an interview we did back in 2013 with Carmen Ortiz, very much around these issues. And it was at the time of the Aaron Swartz case, after he'd committed suicide. We talked about that. Here's just a little bit of her responding to this kind of criticism.
I have heard some of the claims in terms of being overzealous or lack of supervision, and I think they're actually very inaccurate. They're unfair, and they're unwarranted, especially given the number of cases that we do here, and we do handle hundreds of cases, not only that we bring and we charge and proceed with in court, but also the number of investigations that we look at that don't result in charges. So there's a lot of work that we do that the public and certainly the court system never sees.
We heard from Lawrence Lessig, the Harvard professor, who made the point that, for example, the architects of the financial crisis dine at the White House while federal prosecutors are trying to make a felon out of an internet activist who downloaded a bunch of academic journals. So if you can't respond to that specific case, the idea here is one of proportion. I mean, there seems to be a consistent criticism and a consistent set of questions to you about fairness and sense of proportion about the way you're going after certain cases.
Okay, that's very fair, and I will talk to you about proportion because that is important. And, you know, we don't take our responsibility lightly. Some criminal wrongdoing is much more severe than others. And so in our role, what we try to do is determine what is the evidence, what degree of criminal conduct occurred here, and determine what the appropriate charges are and move forward on that.
Well, let me venture one more question related to the Aaron Swartz case. Given what happened, do you have any regrets about how your office conducted that case?
You know, I think that I cannot really respond to it. I will say this, that what happened there was just a tremendous tragedy. And I don't think that there's anything that can occur to rectify that. And I think that much needs to be done in the area, really, of mental illness. And how do we identify that mental illness, and not just prosecutors, defense attorneys, pretrial services, and the court system needs to be engaged in so that we can all do a better job at that.
All right, so that was an excerpt of a conversation we had with U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz back in 2013, who declined to join us today. But Nancy, one of the sort of key points that she made was there's an awful lot of work that this department does that the public might not even be aware of. So is it perhaps unfair to focus on some of these more prominent cases that are grabbing the headlines and sort of, you know, paint her with that brush of these few cases?
That's an interesting question. Most U.S. attorneys, and in fact the Boston Globe has been prominent in touting her successes, which are bona fide successes, human trafficking cases, drug cases, violence cases. There certainly were
successes. The Whitey Bulger case?
That's right. There are certainly successes in the office. But what is of interest in the Huffington Post piece is that you rarely see the acquittals and the cases, a commentary about the cases that shouldn't be brought. There's a line in that article which is very telling. Indictments are on page one. Acquittals are on page 30. So that to some degree, the broader picture is a picture that includes this discussion. But I certainly agree that there have been successes in that office.
I know that it chafes that office. It chafes Carmen Ortiz to have these cases brought up, which are exceptions. But whether they're exceptions or not, there's some extraordinary statements. And I think they are warnings and cautionary advice for the future. There was a case that she prosecuted involving Lorraine Henderson. She was a member of the Department of Homeland Security. A competitor at work knew that she was using a woman, a foreigner, Brazilian, to clean her house. The co-worker reported her. The feds came in. They wired up the illegal alien to set up Lorraine Henderson, and she was charged with a felony. It went before Judge Woodlock, Douglas Woodlock. She was convicted, and the case really bothered him. And in fact, he ordered a new trial in 2012. He wrote, "I view the pursuit of this case to have been overkill through the improvident invocation of federal criminal felony process." And what some people, the authors of this article, might hearken to, he described the U.S. Attorney's Office as showing no restraint of having crushed a person's life by charging a felony rather than what could have been a misdemeanor. And now he concludes with quoting Shakespeare, in a stinging rebuke, "Oh, it is excellent to have a giant's strength, but it is tyrannous to use it like a giant."
It's always good to end a segment with Shakespeare. No, I think we have literally 20 seconds left, Nancy. Let me do offer this final question. In your view, are we talking about an issue with one federal prosecutor, or is there something about the federal prosecution system that needs to be rethought?
Oh, I think it's both, actually. I mean, I think federal prosecutors have enormous power that came from vague statutes and enormous penalties. There's no question that that's a structural problem, but there certainly are errors in judgment in this office, which are worth identifying.
All right. Well, we have a link to the Huffington Post piece at radioboston.org. You can also find a link to David Boeri's terrific work there as well. David Boeri, WBUR senior reporter, and Nancy Gertner, former federal judge. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And listeners, stay with us. Coming up, a tour of the largest U.S. lightship ever built right here in Boston Harbor. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is the bell of the Nantucket Lightship, which is docked in East Boston. The 100-foot ship is painted bright red with the name Nantucket in big white letters along its side. The ship is a floating memorial of sorts, recalling a time before modern navigation devices like GPS, when ocean travel was much more hazardous than it is today.
Basically, a lightship is a floating lighthouse. They put them where it was impractical to build a permanent lighthouse structure.
A floating lighthouse. And this was the biggest, according to Bob Menino, president of the U.S. Lightship Museum, which owns the Nantucket Lightship in Boston. From 1936 until it was decommissioned in 1974, this vessel and its U.S. Coast Guard crew were stationed 100 miles off the Massachusetts coast, where its powerful beacon and foghorn helped guide ships through the Nantucket Shoals, a perilous stretch of shallow sandbars.
And the shoals themselves get as shallow as like 3 feet, and sometimes they break the surface.
Wow.
In fact, that area of the Atlantic is known as one of the graveyards of the Atlantic. Over 700 shipwrecks have occurred on the shoals. So they put a lightship out there in 1854.
The first lightships were wooden sailing vessels that used whale oil to light their beacons. They would stay out for weeks at a time through fog, storms, even hurricanes, lighting a safe way home or out to sea for passing ships. It was dangerous work for those old ships, as well as for the more modern lightships like this one.
That would get your attention.
And for good reason. Lightships were targets. Approaching vessels would steer right toward them. But in the fog, there was always a risk that they wouldn't see them in time to avoid hitting them. So if an approaching ship came within a mile, that alarm would sound.
What that was to prepare to abandon ship. And that happened a few times. Some of the former crew members would say, I remember, you know, being able to almost spit on a ship. You know, you get a ship like the SS United States come by or something, you know, and it'd be pretty scary.
In fact, Bob Menino says the predecessor of this vessel met a tragic end on the Nantucket Shoals, known as the most remote and treacherous lightship station in the world.
So what would happen, you know, before they had radar, the ships would be cutting through the fog, and the Titanic had a sister ship, the RMS Olympic. Looked just like the Titanic. By the time it was foggy, by the time it saw the lightship, they couldn't turn off in time. So they just hit it dead on. It almost cut it in half. The lightship sank, and 7 of the 11 crew members died. As a result, the British government paid reparations to the families, and they paid to have this particular lightship built. And because of the nature of that station, because of the treacherous nature of it, they wanted to build something that was going to be virtually unsinkable and withstand the rough conditions. So this is the largest U.S. lightship ever built. It's double-hulled. It's got double plating on it. And it's got like 43 watertight compartments, so if it was ever split in half or hit, compromised, it would still float.
This lightship was never hit, but it did survive a number of near misses and at least two hurricanes. Bob Menino says in 1954, Hurricane Edna, packing 100-mile-an-hour winds and 80-foot seas, slammed into the Nantucket lightship.
Anchor chain broke, a rogue wave came, hit the ship with such force, it buckled some of the hull plates, smashed through the portholes on the bridge, and tore off the wheel on the helm station, shorted out all the electrical panels, completely shut the ship down.
So they were just adrift.
Yes.
In the middle of a hurricane.
Yes. The water went down the stack, put out the boilers, so they had no power whatsoever. And so the danger was that the ship not being able to point it correctly into the seas, that the ship would broach and, you know, turn over. So what happened was, when they got the ship powered up again, they couldn't steer it because the rudder was so badly bent from the force of the seas. But, you know, lifeboats were washed overboard. But what happened was, they finally got the auxiliary anchor down, rode out the storm, and then after that it was towed back to Boston and had all the repairs done. So, but it was
harrowing tale.
Oh.
That was a rough place out there. You rocked and rolled. And I mean just rocking and rolling.
As a young Coast Guard captain back in 1970, Peter Brunk did a lot of rocking and rolling aboard the Nantucket lightship. Brunk says he and his crew spent 3 weeks on the ship and 3 weeks off in Boston. And what he remembers most were the rough seas, 90-foot waves, the fog, and the constant fear of getting hit by an approaching ship.
Every trip we'd have 4 or 5 times, we'd have to everybody get life jackets on, get the small boat ready to go overboard, and just get ready to get hit. And the ship would come, and they would come down alongside of you maybe 200 feet away and just chug, 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 chug. Sometimes you could hear them, but you couldn't even see them. It was so foggy. I mean, I've seen us blow the horn for 14 days and 14 nights. Couldn't see nothing. And in the wintertime, it was snowing all the time.
Today, restoration work continues on the Nantucket lightship, but the vessel was almost lost forever. After it was decommissioned in 1974, it fell into disrepair and sat idle for years and was ready for the scrapyard until Bob Menino set up a nonprofit to buy it for $1. Now Menino continues to raise money to restore and preserve this piece of maritime history. Bob, I'm just interested what inspired you personally to take this on. I mean, it sounds like without you, this might have been just a pile of scrap. Why was this so important to you?
Well, I guess I've always considered myself somewhat of a preservation activist. Just something about the lure of the sea that keeps me fascinated. And plus, it's more than a piece of steel. I mean, I look at this, it's got like kind of a soul to it. Yeah. You know, a vessel like this helps save lives. And the people that served in this vessel put their lives at risk. So they're heroes.
The Nantucket Lightship became known as the Statue of Liberty of the Sea, because it was the first sign of America that many immigrants would see as they approached the East Coast. Today, it's open to the public, and last August, its powerful beacon lit up and shined over Boston Harbor for the first time in 40 years. And you can see some photos and read a little bit more about the Nantucket Lightship at our website, radioboston.org. That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.